Call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, March 5th, 2020, and the time is 10:21. Members present, Representative Lavon, Representative Telton, Vice Chair Ortiz, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Wohl, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, Representative Foster, or Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Representative Johnston. Today's agenda includes House Bill 186, naming the Irene Weber Bridge, House Bill 230, Intensive Management Surcharge, Repeal and Termination Date, House Bill 197, Extend Seismic Hazard Safety Commission, and House Bill 159, Medical Education Program. House Bill 186, an act naming the Irene Weber Bridge, is back before the committee for us to hear responses from DOT on the fiscal note and then look to the will of the committee to move this bill. I would like to invite Sarah Perman to the table to do a short reintroduction of the bill. Your name on the record.
Good morning, through the chair to the committee. My name is Sarah Perman. I'm in the office of Representative Louise Stutz. Just to remind you, this bill is naming a bridge over mile 9.5 in Cordova, the Irene Weber Bridge. She was a former Cordovan, and she was an avid runner in the community, and this is a bridge that goes right across the marathon that she was responsible for founding goes right across this, and it's a tribute to her. So that's it.
Thank you very much. And could we have Mr. Matt Walker with DOT up to discuss the fiscal note and the response dated March 3rd.
Madam Chair, Matt Walker, State Traffic and Safety Engineer with DOT.
And I think each of you have seen in your packet the response from DOT. Are there any questions? You want a minute to look at it, or are we set? Seeing no questions, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
I do, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 186, which is 31-LS1251/M, from committee with the attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 186 passes from the committee. Thank you. May everything be so easy. House Bill 230, an act repealing the termination date for the intensive management hunting license surcharge. Could we please have the bill introduction for Representative Lincoln and Elizabeth Ferguson, staff to Representative Lincoln.
Good morning, Co-Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Foster, and members of the committee. Thank you for making time for House Bill 230 today. This, for the record, this is John Lincoln, representative for House District 40. I'm joined today by Elizabeth Ferguson from our office, who will introduce the committee to the bill.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Johnston and Foster and committee members. My name is Elizabeth Ferguson, and I work in Representative John Lincoln's office. Today you have House Bill 230 in front of you. It's a one-line bill that repeals the sunset date for the intensive management surcharge. The surcharge was first implemented after legislation passed in 2016, authorizing the collection for it at a rate of $10 per resident hunting license and $30 per non-resident hunting license. In its 3 years, the surcharge has grossed just about $3.1 million. House Bill 230 does not increase or change the surcharge amount per hunting license, and it does not change policy on intensive management. It just funds activities and will continue to allow the department to use much of that money for federal match. If you look at the pie charts from fiscal years 18 and 19, you see that the lion's share of the expenditures go towards research and management. This is when the scientists and researchers determine all of the factors at play, because each case varies from one to another. And that data-driven approach and use for the funds in that manner is why the program has been so successful, and we'd like to continue that. Right now, most of the surcharge is used for 1-3 match for Pittman-Robertson funds. You can see that it has a zero fiscal note. However, the fiscal note shows that without the surcharge revenue, the department could stand to lose up to $4 million, making management, research, surveying, and inventory more challenging. And walking through the sectional quickly, Section 1 reads that the current sunset provision will be repealed with the passage of this bill. And that wraps up my sectional. And online we have Director Eddie Grasser with the Division of Wildlife Conservation in case there are any questions.
Thank you, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, could I ask Mr. Grasser a question, Madam Co-Chair?
Yes, Mr. Grasser, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Grasser, I'm just confirming that the federal match cannot be used for predator control itself. Is that a true statement?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, no, it's not. But because of the constraints that the federal land managers have on their lands and other issues, we've chosen never to use PR dollars, if at all possible, for actual predator management.
Follow up?
Mr.
Grasser, does that include not using it on state lands?
That's correct. Through the chair.
And just to follow up.
Mr.
Grasser, I don't doubt you for a second on your statement, but I am curious, and I mean this as genuinely as I can. I'm repeatedly told, in fact, I was told this week by someone who works in the department and actually came to visit me on an entirely, totally different issue, that PM dollars cannot be used for predator control, but you seem to say they could, it's just the department uses its discretion to not do it. Why is there this, why do people keep telling me incorrectly that you can't use PM dollars on predator control?
Through the chair, Representative Justison, I'm not sure I can answer that or what other people are thinking. But there's nothing in the statutory language that houses the Pittman-Robertson Act and statutes that bars a state from conducting predator management programs using PR dollars.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, at this point, we will put this on hold, and thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have House Bill 197, an act extending the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission and providing for effective date. Representative Tuck and Mike Mason, staff to Representative Tuck, please come up and introduce yourself. And I understand that we have Steve Masterman, Geological and Geographical Survey Division Director, and Sterling Strait online. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. Thank you, co-chairs and vice chair. For the record, my name is Chris Tuck. I'm the state representative for House District 23, South Central Anchorage, also known as the Diamond Business District. Thanks again for hearing House Bill 197, and this is to extend the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission. As we know, Alaska is one of the most seismically active regions on Earth, with a history of very large and damaging earthquakes. In January, the Alaska Earthquake Center issued a summary of Alaska's seismic activity for the year 2019. The report should be there in your packet. And in that report, it demonstrates that Alaska experienced 50,289 earthquakes just last year in 2019, which is the second most in Alaska's history. And so far this year, there's been 7,050 earthquakes. The state of Alaska has worked diligently to prepare for future earthquakes to ensure the safety of our people and of our infrastructure. As part of this work, the state created the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission back in 2001. This commission provides recommendations on goals and priorities to mitigate seismic hazards in Alaska through gathering and disseminating information on how to reduce Alaska's vulnerability to earthquakes and renewing earthquake recovery and reconstruction efforts to make recommendations to improve these efforts. The commission is made up of volunteer experts and key government officials to provide advice to policymakers on disaster preparedness and seismic hazard mitigation. The commission is staffed by the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. The latest annual report for the commission was included in your bill packet as well. House Bill 197 would extend the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission through June 30th, 2028, as recommended from the recent audit that we had performed on them. The bill includes an immediate effective date because the current authorization expires at the end of June. And that recent audit is in your bill packet. The audit of the commission included a specific recommendation to extend the commission to that 2028 deadline. And they see a public policy need for this commission's existence. With us, we also have Chris Curtis, our Auditor General. She will go through the results of the audit. We also have online the Director of Division, Steve Masterman, if you have any questions. In conclusion, Alaska is threatened by earthquakes 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, pretty much all the time. The Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission has played a key role in preparing the public and private sectors for future earthquakes. And with the passage of House Bill 197, we'll make sure the commission's efforts continue.
Thank you. And Mr. Mason, will you do a sectional?
Yes, through the chair. House Bill 197 amends AS 44.66.010, and it essentially just changes the sunset date from June 30th, 2020 to June 30th, 2028. And as Representative Kristuck noted, the act takes effect immediately. And that's the quick sectional. Thank you.
Thank you. And would Chris Curtis like to come up? Our legislative auditor.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. I believe you have a copy of the audit in your packets. It's dated March of 2019. And just as a reminder, a sunset audit, the purpose of the audit is to determine whether a border commission is serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. The audit found that there continues to be a public policy need for this commission's continued existence, and we're recommending the maximum extension allowable in statute, which is 8 years. If you turn to page 9 of your audit, you will see a schedule of expenditures, and you will note that this is a fairly low-cost way of leveraging the volunteer expertise. Annual expenditures range from just over $3,500 a year to just over $13,000. If you turn to page 12, you'll see a summary of their activities during our audit period, and you can see from this schedule that it's a very active commission. I did want to draw your attention to the third bullet under strategic plan goal number 2. During the audit period, the commission helped secure FEMA grants that were used by school districts to assess the vulnerabilities of school buildings to significant structure during a major earthquake. The number of the buildings assessed and the location is listed there on the bottom of page 12. We also looked at how the commission helped respond to the major earthquake in November 2018. On page 14, we note that after the earthquake, the commission provided a list of certified evaluators who had assessment training to assist with inspecting structures. A total of 11 volunteers assisted with damage assessments, 8 of which had completed training sponsored by the commission in September 2018, just a few months before the earthquake. Additionally, several commission members helped with damage assessments by working directly with state agencies. We also note that FEMA did reach out to the commission after the earthquake and requested their assistance in generating a damage report with future recommendations for preparedness. We did identify 2 administrative improvements, and they begin on page 16. First, we recommend that the commission chair ensure procedures are implemented to publish meeting notices timely and accurately So we tested 25 meetings during the audit period. Five of them were either not public noticed or not public noticed timely. Page 17, we recommend the commission chair ensure the strategic plan is updated to reflect the current goals and priorities based on experience. As far as responses to the audit, they begin on page 27. Both the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources and the chair of the commission agreed with the findings and recommendations and have communicated that corrective action has been taken.
Are there any questions? Thank you. So at this point, we will set this aside and hold it. Thank you. Next, we have House Bill 159, an act relating to repayment conditions for medical education program participants. We'll have a bill reintroduction by Representative Christ Tompkins and staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the second hearing on WAMI, happy to field questions the committee may have.
Are there any questions? Would you like just a brief overview again of what the legislation does?
Madam Chair, no to that question, but I got to tell you that I just really appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward. I think he's spot on the bill, and I'm going to be glad to support it.
If there's no questions, I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room or anybody online wishing to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Is there any additional committee discussion? So we'll have an amendment deadline of Friday, March 6th at 5 p.m. And again, I will set this aside and hold it over. So our agenda for this afternoon, the agenda for Thursday, March 5th, 2020 at 1:30 p.m. Public testimony for House Bill 127, Dental Hygienist Advanced Practice Permit, House Bill 182, Sexual Assault Examination Kits Testing. We'll have a review for fiscal notes for HB 30, the Workman's Comp, Death and Permanent Partial Impairment. Does anybody have any questions? Okay. We will adjourn, and the time is 10:39. Thank you. I call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, March 5th, 2020, and the time is 1:36. Members present, Representative Lebon, Representative Tilton, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Wall, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, and myself, Representative Jennifer Johnston. Today's agenda is House Bill 127, Dental Hygienist Advanced Practice Permit, House Bill 182, Sexual Assault Examination Kit Testing, and HB 30, Workman's Comp, Death, Permanent Partial Impairment. House Bill 127, an act relating to the practice of dental hygiene, establishing advanced practice permit, prohibiting unfair discrimination under group health insurance against a dental hygienist who holds an advanced practice permit relating to medical assistance for dental hygiene services and providing for effective date. For the bill reintroduction, Representative Sponholz and her staff, Casey Desort, would you like to come to the table and introduce yourself and put your names on the record?
Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chair. HB 127 creates an advanced practice permit, which would allow dental hygienists to provide care for underserved populations at senior centers, healthcare facilities, daycares and schools, and for Alaskans who are eligible for public assistance, homebound, or serve in an underserved community. It would be available for dental hygienists who have a minimum of 4,000 hours of clinical experience and who are approved by the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners. Dental hygienists, Alaska wouldn't be the first state to make these changes. Dental hygienists are able to practice under advanced practice permits or similar permits in 6 other states, and in 40 other states are considered direct access states, meaning dental hygienists can initiate treatment based on their assessment of a patient's need without the authorization or the presence of a dentist.
Thank you. Are there any questions before we go on to public testimony? Okay, I'd like to open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room or online that wishes to testify? And if so, could you please introduce yourself to put your name on the record?
Hello, my name is Dominic Wenzel.
Yes.
Hello, thank you, committee. I am a dentist on the Alaska Dental Board, and Dr. Nielsen was not available, so he asked me to call in. We discussed HB 127 at our board meeting earlier this week, and the board feels the HB 127 addresses the concerns the dental board had with the original Senate version and that the dental board supports House Bill 127 as written.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I do not see any questions. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify? Is this Katrina Virgin? Are you online?
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. For the record, Katrina Virgin, president of the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association. And I, of course, am calling in to provide testimony and also here mostly just to answer any questions if any questions arise during this proceeding. Yes, we definitely support the advanced practice permit all across the state. We've seen a big need that needs to be filled, and we would like to be able to practice to the extent of our licensure and abilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I do not see any questions, so thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room or online who'd like to testify? Seeing no one in the room or online, public testimony is closed. We have a fiscal note, and we have Brenda Vincent, online, Medicaid Program Specialist, Division of Healthcare Services, and Melissa, no, we do not have Melissa Hill, but we have Sharon Walsh online. Are there questions for either of them as far as the fiscal note? Representative Telton.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We have a fiscal note before us that's OMB component 3234 that shows a cost at implementation of this to the Alaska Health Enterprise System at $250,000. Could maybe somebody just explain that?
Ms. Vincent, would you like to respond to Representative Telton? Oh, excuse me. Actually, one second, please. Do we have somebody from OMB here? Oh. Oh, Melissa Hills. Would you like to come up to the table and put yourself on the record?
For the record, my name is Melissa Hill. I work for Healthcare Services. Through the chair, Representative Telton. The $250,000 is explained a couple ways. So part of that time is hours to work on claims adjudication and payment process. This is a brand new billing provider, and we haven't added one of these to the system since go live. So that cost is about $187,000. To do a provider change then, once we have it all in and get it set up as a provider, that is about 600 hours worth of time, and that comes out to $63,000.
Thank you. I guess my concern is last year, I think we had Senate Bill 105, the marital and family therapy licenses, and Senate Bill 134 was for the licensed counselor. And the fiscal notes on both of those were $50,000. So what is the difference with this one?
So the change with this one is this is creating a brand new provider type. Oh, Chair, I'm sorry, I apologize. And those were able to bill under a health group, and I think Director Gayhart's on, and Brenda Vincent can correct me on that. The difference in cost is if we're just doing a provider type change, it's about 600 hours. And the reason those were about $50,000 is because our cost per hour with the contractor has increased.
Ms. Vincent, would you like to add anything to this?
Hi, for the record, this is Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services.
Sorry.
My apologies, I just finished up with another call, but I'm happy to take that question. I also wanted to let folks know that there was a price increase on the modification hours with our contractor, as Ms. Hill had said. Between last year and this year, that's the difference between the $50,000 that you saw with the LMFTs and the $63,000 that you saw with licensed professional counselors. These particular claims will be adjudicated through the newly established ASO with Optum, their behavioral health claims. So the only cost to and through the healthcare services fiscal agent is the enrollment component. We won't be doing the claims adjudication on those, so that price wasn't included. We will be doing the claims adjudication for the dental hygienist under their new provider type.
Are there any questions? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, through the chair, every time you add another type of provider, the 600 hours of basically your programming, it's going into a software system and adding, say, dental hygienist as a provider, because currently they're under the umbrella of a dentist, I'm assuming. A nurse practitioner would be a provider, behavioral health, chiropractic, whatever it is. So just to add one provider, which physical therapy or whatever, each time you add one type of provider, 600 hours is pretty standard, huh?
That's true.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, yes, that is a standard time.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just not knowing much about it. Is this sort of industry standard, or is this software particularly cumbersome?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, this is, again, Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services. This is actually one of the first times we've had this system in place with Conduent, who is our fiscal agent, since 2013. Very rarely are new provider types added to the system. Often they are added as rendering providers affiliated to a provider. So this is industry standard for implementing a new provider type or a provider ID. And yes, the 63,000 is standard for any new provider type, just for the enrollment component. And it is all of the hard coding for the system to be able to accept that provider type.
Follow up. So the additional 180,000, is that also, would that be standard in adding a provider type? And that wasn't with behavioral health, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry for asking you to repeat yourself, but can you go over the 180,000?
Through the chair, yes. That portion is for the claims adjudication. So if I can give you just a brief example. So the dental hygienists right now are paid for under the dental provider's number. They have a subset of codes that they can provide for cleaning and other items. So what claims adjudication does is ensures that as claims come through the system, they edit to ensure that that particular provider type is able to bill for those codes and are paid the correct amount for that. So claims adjudication, again, it's building logic into the system so that it pays claims appropriately and denies those that it shouldn't pay.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would the reason that behavioral health is simpler to enter into the system is because there's fewer codes that they're billing out for? It's more of a, because hygienists are providing more individual code of service?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, actually it's because those particular claims will now be run through the Administrative Service Organization, or Optum. They're not paid through the MMIS, which is Conduent, which is the fiscal agent that the dental hygienist will be under. So the LMFTs and the licensed professional counselors are being paid through a different system.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you. So, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I have a question, I think, for the sponsors of the bill. Representative Sponholz, why this particular bill is, of course, designed to help underserved communities is another maybe potential benefit of this bill. Would it end up help to drive down costs put forward towards dental hygiene and things like that? Would it drive down statewide costs in any way?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, this is Representative Ivy Sponholz, House District 16. It's difficult at this point in time to project concretely any cost savings that could be result from this. But what is sort of expected is that with the people that are identified to be served by dental hygienists practicing independently, with their getting more preventative care, they're likely to need less. Surgeries, removals, you know, they're going to have fewer cavities, those kinds of things, which should then save us money down the long run. It is that's the whole purpose of actually getting preventive dental in the first place. You might remember this last year we had a very in-depth conversation about the value of preventative dental versus, you know, sort of only, you know, emergent and treatment related dental, and we know from looking at it as a, you know, preventative dental as a whole that it actually saves the state money. So it's our hypothesis that an investment in increasing access to preventative dental will save us money down the road.
Follow up? Yeah, I guess a follow-up as well. The reason why I asked that specific question is, like, I can see on this list of underserved communities that Ketchikan Indian Corporation or Ketchikan Indian Community is on the list. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, firsthand that they currently employ dentists there, mm-hmm. So people who go there have access to dentists. Mm-hmm. Would this be an opportunity for them in the future to, rather than if a dentist leaves, hire a new dentist, would they then be allowed to hire a nurse practitioner, a dental hygienist, to fill what at one time was being done by a dentist?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, yes, they should be able to hire an advanced practice dental hygienist if this bill were to become law, and would allow them to pay that person less, which would save money in our total health care spend in the state.
Thank you. Thanks.
Either Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, following along the lines of the questions from Representative Ortiz, you mentioned it would save money in the long run. Do you anticipate if you go to an underserved area or underserved population that hasn't had a lot of basic primary dental care, hygiene, et cetera, that people will go in and find a bunch of problems that will need dental, full dentist intervention? I know every time I go to the dentist, not every time, but I often think I'm in great dental health, and they go, oh, no, we got a problem here and a problem there and a problem there and a problem there. Next thing I know, I'm lined up for a bunch of dentist appointments that I didn't really want. So I guess that's a woodwork effect, or I don't know what they call it in the dental world, a flossing effect or something. But is that in any way anticipated or accounted for?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, it is possible that if you have people that are would be getting, you know, some preventative dental care and screening, they were getting cleanings and getting a, you know, superficial, you know, an initial exam, if they hadn't seen a dental health care provider in a while, that they would, we would, you know, their providers would identify potential cavities and other things that needed treatment. And so you could see sort of, you know, a short-term upswing in terms of utilization, and then it's expected that it would go down again. And that short-term upswing in treatment would probably save us a lot of money on the longer term, because, you know, if you get a cavity while it's small, it's a lot easier to treat, it's less expensive, it's less painful, you're less likely to have an extraction or a crown or those kinds of things. It's cheaper to do, you know, a simple, you know, small cavity treatment than it is to do a crown, for example, having had a few of those myself. It's a painful and expensive project that requires several dentist visits, like, you know, so yeah.
Thank you. Do you have a question?
Not a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a comment. I support this bill. I am sometimes we do things that folks on the ground see that we do not. And so I did reach out to my local hospital back in Nome, Norton Sound Health Corporation, and just asked them to take a look at the bill. They looked at it. They serve 15 villages in our region, and they said they like the bill, they support the bill, and so just wanted to share that with folks, and so I'll be supportive of it. Thanks.
Okay, I see no other questions. The amendment deadline is for this bill, House Bill 127, is March 9th at 5 p.m., and at this point I'll set this aside and hold it. Next, we will have House Bill 182, an act relating to the testing of sexual assault examination kits and providing for effective date. We'll have a bill reintroduction by Representative Tarr, And staff to Representative Carla Hart.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. Thank you for the second opportunity to come before you for this important legislation. I guess just the quick recap would be that currently our state law says that the rape kits have to be processed within 1 year, and this bill will change that to 6 months.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing no questions, we will... Oh, do you have a question?
No.
Sure. We will open public testimony. And I see in the room we have Carmen Laurie. Would you come up and put yourself on the record and who you represent?
Hello. For the record, my name is Carmen Laurie, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I want to first start off by thanking you all for this opportunity. I also want to say it's a beautiful place to be and to sit. It's such a beautiful view today. The Network is a membership-based organization of 21 programs across the state who provide community-based services for victims and survivors of domestic violence. We also engage in prevention work, and of course we engage in advocacy work to create conditions where sexual and domestic violence doesn't occur, and that to make sure that victims and survivors are treated with the utmost respect when their rights have been violated. We've been working with Representative Tarr on different iterations of the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, and on this one we are very pleased to be able to say that we're very supportive. We support the committee substitute of this bill. What it does, the 6 months, it doesn't maybe sound like a lot. We started out last year, it was 12 months, and then once the crime lab realized that we could move to a shorter period of getting information back to survivors, Representative Tarr thought that that would be a good thing to introduce with the 6 months, and it is. And I think that what is critical to realize is what it means is that for a victim who actually goes and reports of sexual assault or sexual violence crime, during that time period before they know what happens, during that time period after they report to the law enforcement, after they go to the medical facility and undergo a forensic exam, they don't know what's going on, and things have been taken from them. And so this just reduces that period of anxiety, it reduces that period of fear, it reduces that period of anger, and it provides some relief to a victim or survivor. And it's a really strong message from the state to say we care about you and we're going to get this done in 6 months because we know we can do it. So I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I would like to say yes, it's very beautiful in this room, but it'd be a lot nicer being outside.
Thank you.
The amendment deadline for House Bill 182 will be Monday, March 9th at 5 p.m. And at this point, at ease. Call this meeting back to order. Is there anybody else in the room or online? We'll be closing this public testimony. And amendments will be due to House Bill 182 Monday, March 9th at 5 p.m. And at this point, I'll set this aside and hold it over. Next, we'll have House Bill 30. Thank you all. House Bill 30, an act relating to the notice of workman's compensation death benefits, relating to the payment of workers' compensation benefits in case of permanent partial impairments, relating to the payments of workers' compensation's death benefits payable to a child of an employee with there's no surviving spouse and providing for effective date. We will have a bill reintroduction by Representative Josephson and Elise Thornburg, staff to Representative Josephson. Thank you, Representative Josephson, for doing the very great coughing into the sleeve.
Thank you. I What was that? Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been working on that as well as studying up on my bill. So I'm Andy Josephson. I represent House District 17 in Anchorage. And with me is my staff, Elise Soren-Burke. And would you like a reintroduction to the bill and the CS in particular?
Just a brief, yes. Sure.
So it's quite simple. When a person is partially injured at work, a doctor declares whether or not they have a degree of disability. And sometimes it would be obvious to the eye, and sometimes you'd need to do further study. For example, a back injury. And we have a permanent partial impairment rating, and it's a mouthful, but basically permanent, you can't fix it. Partial, you're still alive. Impairment, that's the degree of the disability. We then have a whole body multiplier, and it's that multiplier that the bill changes because it's a 20-year-old multiplier. The effect of having a 20-year-old multiplier is to put us, and it's a little tricky to calculate because some states do it differently, but we're very likely in sort of the 40 to 50 of the 50 states placement in this category. So what we're trying to do, and your file should reflect this from last year, is move us into about 25th or 26th place. So we're not trying to set a record in terms of our generosity toward folks who have been injured permanently at work. And that's the nature of the bill. The main change the bill makes from the previous year is it deletes a category of death benefit for what I call the single childless worker. In place of that, it requires that a new worker in Alaska receive notice of their workers' comp benefits. This is designed, having talked to some members of the committee who were concerned about this new death benefit that we had in 2019 in the bill and no longer have now, this is designed to put folks on notice, hopefully, that if they are single and childless, they might want to purchase life insurance because there's no remedy for their family if they were to pass away. That's essentially what it does. It does one other minor thing. Currently under law, if someone is essentially an orphan and they're, for example, if a person were 17 or 18 years old and say their mother had already passed away and they lived with their father, and then he were to die at work, thankfully this doesn't happen often, they, under current law, would have, starting at age 19, they'd have 4 years of continuing help through the workers' comp system. But that would only be true if they were enrolled in a VOTEC program, trade school essentially, or college. And what this bill says is, let's give them that 4 years, even if they're serving in Iraq in the U.S. Marines, or if they're fishermen and they don't need to go to trade or want to go to trade school or college. In that respect, it's not going to be substantially more expensive. One could judge that as fairer in that it captures all types of different people in that roughly 19 to 23 age category. And that's what the bill does.
Are there any questions before we go on to the fiscal note? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess on that point, was the initial reasoning to provide up to 22 or 23-year-old while an individual dependent was in school not earning money? Is that sort of the distinction between someone who's in school and someone who's in the workforce? Or was the other requirement that, not that they're in the workforce, but just that they're in school, and that's why they'd continue to be a dependent?
Through the chair, that, Representative Wolf, that could be. The language, actually, in 2333.95 is a little bit odd, and we're not changing that. But it seems to suggest someone could be 40 years old, and if they had a 65-year-old father who was still, for example, working and died at work because of a work-related accident, they could be eligible. Now, it's technical because it sort of suggests that they better be enrolled at the moment of death. In other words, they better, if they're 40 and they want to continue the benefit, it might be best if they had enrolled sort of by happenstance when they were 39. So it's a little bit odd, but we're not changing that. We're just saying in this window of time from 19 to 23, this benefit, and I must tell you that the benefit is not going to be, I mean, we could take a look at that, but it's no one's going to get rich on this benefit.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So you brought to mind another question of an individual who's 40 living with a parent, and the parent dies at work. Is there language for a dependent that's disabled, I guess? And yeah, I guess that's the question. A 40-year-old who lives with their parent because they can't live on their own.
Through the chair, Representative, well, actually, I'm not sure. Again, this is existing law, and the committee's welcome to look at that, but we're not tinkering with it.
Right.
But I don't think it does require that they live with their parent. However, specifically to your question, yes, there is a category in the law now so that if, for example, someone was cognitively or physically disabled, they could get their weekly allowance for a very long time. And that's true now, and it would remain true in the same way under the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Madam Chair, Representative Josephson, you mentioned that if we were to adopt House Bill 30, it would put the state in the quote, kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of compensation for death. Is that so? Are we right now? Where are we? Are we at the very bottom?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So it's not compensation for death. That's a whole other matter. It's compensation for a permanent injury. Okay. So we are according. In my view, here's my answer. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development 2 years ago said that we are, for the loss of an arm from the shoulder down, very serious accident, okay, we are 32nd. For the loss of a hip, we're 33rd. Loss of an eye, 35th. Loss of an ear, 33rd. Now, you may see that number and say, well, 33rd isn't great, but it's not 45th. However, I think it really is 45th. And the reason I say that is there are about 10 or 11 states that have a totally different system of calculating it. So, for example, and this is a document straight from the Department of Labor, this page that I'm holding up shows the loss of one eye at work. And Alaska isn't even on the page. You have to flip the page to get to where it is. So, If you lose an eye at work in Maryland, your workers' comp plan will pay you $250,000, a little more. If you lose an eye here, you will receive $44,000. That's a lot less, right? It's less than 20% of what you get in Maryland.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'd also like to note that the number we used in the bill was based on inflation as well.
So I see that Mr. Mitchell's in the room, or maybe not Mr. Mitchell. Mr. Jordan, yes. Sorry, Mr. Jordan, it says Mr. Mitchell here. Oh, he's online. I'm sorry, it's me again. Mr. Mitchell is online and Mr. Jordan is here. Would you like to discuss the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, this is Gray Mitchell, the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. I will discuss our fiscal notes. We have two fiscal notes. One deals with the workers' compensation component. And this fiscal note illustrates that there There will be a revenue increase associated with increasing the permanent partial impairment benefits, and that revenue increase is estimated at $110,000 per year. And so if you look at the fiscal note for the workers' compensation component, you'll see that in FY21, it shows a $55,000 increase in revenue. And then from years fiscal year 22 through fiscal years 26, it shows $110,000 in increased revenue. And this is based on the 44% increase in permanent partial impairment benefits. And the reason why that increases revenue to the division is that there are two essentially taxes. One is collected by the Division of Insurance on all premiums issued, and so that 44% increase can be expected to increase premiums in a like amount. And the other revenue source is a service fee placed on self-insured employers, such as the state of Alaska and other large employers who have the resources to self-insure. And those insurers are required to pay 2.9% of all of the indemnity benefits that they pay out over the year. And so that's where we've come up with the figures for the fiscal note. Are there any questions on that one fiscal note?
Are there any questions? I don't see any questions.
Okay. The second fiscal note deals with the second injury fund, which in Alaska there is a fund that pays benefits for workers who have pre-existing conditions and have claims that meet certain conditions. And in order to pay those claims, there is an assessment against all of the indemnity benefits that are paid out over a year by all employers. And the assessment is based on the amount of revenue that's in the account at a given time over the year, and then the claims that are charged against the account to determine a reserve rate. And so this last year, the reserve rate was set at 5%. And so for every dollar of indemnity benefit payment, an employer is required to submit 5% to the second injury fund. And so again, based on this 44% increase, and that relates to an estimate of an increase of $4.2 million in indemnity payments. And that's based on the total amount of indemnity benefit payments that were made in 2018 multiplied by 44%. And so the estimated amount of the increase is $105,000 for FY21 and then $210,000 for fiscal year 2022 through fiscal year 2026 for each year.
Are there any questions? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. There's some verbiage on the second page of this fiscal note. It says studies indicate that significant benefit increases are typically accompanied by changes in claimant behavior. And then it says changes in claimant behavior might result in increased number of PPI claims. So more people are going to claim they lost an eye because they're going to get another few that. I mean, for this kind of impairment, I can't see there being extra claims. Is that, did some people really? Maybe there's claims I don't know about, like, but I would think loss of limb would be pretty hard to fake.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that is obviously true. the National Council of Compensation Insurance had done a fairly extensive evaluation based on last year's version of House Bill 30, and this language was in that analysis. And so to the extent that it changing the benefits by such a large amount, 44% in a single year, might influence claimant behavior, it is a consideration. Obviously, it's hard to, you know, I mean, no one's going to fake the loss of an eye or something like that. But it is something that the NCCI had included in their analysis, so we included it in our fiscal note explanation.
Thank you. I just wanted to point it out.
Are there any other questions? Representative Telton. For either Mr. Jordan or Mr. Mitchell, are there any questions?
And Madam Chair, just to be clear, I know Mr. Jordan has a separate fiscal note for Department of Administration, and you know that fiscal note kind of helps to show the impact on an employer, because his fiscal note shows costs to the state associated with increasing the PPI benefit amount.
And Mr. Jordan, would you like to speak to that?
Yes. For the record, Scott Jordan, I'm the Director of Risk Management for the Department of Administration. As Director Mitchell said, our fiscal note reflects the 44% increase on what we pay out for the permanent partial impairment rating. If you look at the fiscal note, you'll see that we did a 10-year average of what we pay out, and that 10-year average, I'm sure I've got my numbers right here, that 10-year average was $979,286 a year. That does fluctuate from year to year, but that's the average. The 44% increase would increase that amount by $434,313. And then the fee that Director Mitchell was talking about is also included in there for $26,059. So the fiscal note for FY21 would be half of that, because the effective date is halfway through the year. So that'd be $230,200. And then the out years from FY22 through FY26 would be $460,400.
Are there any questions for Mr. Jordan? Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a comment about that. We are in the odd position of wanting to see a fiscal note, because the point of the bill is to provide more benefit. But we would note that the workers' compensation annual report, and the last one is from 2018, shows total compensation payments statewide have decreased from $292 million in 2015, and now they're at $225 in 2018. Now, I don't know if that's because of our recession, or I hope it's not. I hope it's because of workplace safety. But there's been a decrease of about something close to just under $70 million in indemnity and medical benefits payments.
Are there any questions of either Mr. Mitchell or Mr. Jordan? Thank you. The amendment deadline for this will be also March 9th at 5 p.m. And at this point, I'll be setting it aside. Our next meeting will be Friday, March 6, 2020 at 9 a.m. Meeting will be here. The House Bill 187, Restrict Out-of-State Correctional Facilities. Do any members have anything before we adjourn? Okay. We will adjourn at 2:20 p.m.